This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Welcome. I'm Natalie Pinchem, and this is the October 31st, 2014 podcast, which includes 12 articles on the following topics: oncology, trauma, traumatic brain injury, anatomy, epilepsy, vascular disorders, functional neurosurgery, pain, and stereotactic radiosurgery. Intraoperative computed tomography for intracranial electrode implantation surgery in medically refractory epilepsy. A clinical article by Darren Lee and colleagues. Accurate placement of intracranial depth and subdural electrodes is important in evaluating patients with medically refractory epilepsy for possible resection. However, confirming electrode location on postoperative CT scans does not allow immediate replacement of malpositioned electrodes, and thus revision surgery is required in select cases. Intraoperative CT using the Medtronic O-arm imaging device has been performed to detect electrode locations in deep brain stimulation surgery, but its application in epilepsy surgery has not been explored. Here, the authors implanted electrodes in 10 patients by using preoperative stereotactic planning and intraoperative neuronavigation. Using the O-arm required minor modifications in patient positioning and operative field preparation, but the device did not obstruct surgeon access for burr hole or craniotomy surgery. The depth and subdural electrode locations were easily identified on intraoperative CT and were merged with preoperative MRI studies, allowing for immediate confirmation of lead locations. In one patient, the hippocampal depth electrode was believed to be in a suboptimal position and was repositioned before final wound closure. In this study, the authors found that the O-arm could be easily incorporated into routine intracranial electrode implantation surgery. This imaging technique provided accurate 3D visualization of depth and subdural electrode contacts, and the images could be easily merged with preoperative MRI studies to confirm lead positions prior to closure. Intraoperative CT obviates the need for routine postoperative CT scanning. It has the potential to improve the accuracy of intracranial electroencephalography recordings and may reduce the necessity for revision surgery. The natural clinical course of hemodynamically stable adult Moyamoya disease. A clinical article by Won Sang Cho and co-authors. Moyamoya disease is a rare cerebrovascular disease, and its natural history is still unclear. The authors aim to investigate the natural history of hemodynamically stable cases of adult Moyamoya disease with the analysis of stroke risk factors. A total of 241 cases were retrospectively evaluated in this study. The mean age of the patients at the time of their first visit was 41 years, and 69% were women. According to their initial clinical presentations, the patients were divided into three groups: hemorrhagic, which represented 26%, ischemic, which represented 60% of the patients, and asymptomatic, which was 14%. The mean duration of follow-up was about 83 months. The annual stroke risk was 4.5% overall. In the hemorrhagic group, the annual risk of re-bleeding was 4.3%, and in the ischemic group, the annual risk of recurrent ischemic events was 3%. There was no significant difference in cumulative stroke risk among the three groups. In multivariate analysis, thyroid disease was a significant risk factor for stroke. Initial hemorrhagic presentation was a significant risk factor for re-bleeding, and initial ischemic presentation was a significant risk factor for recurrent ischemic strokes. Familial Moyamoya disease was a common factor for any type of strokes. Among the three groups, the hemorrhagic group had the worst clinical status at both initial presentation and most recent follow-up. Four patients died of recurrent hemorrhage in all four cases, and all four patients were in the hemorrhagic group. Myelin-forming cell-specific cadherin-19 is a marker for minimally infiltrative glioblastoma stem-like cells. A laboratory investigation by Michael Zorniak and colleagues. Current therapies for glioblastoma likely fail because they do not successfully target cancer stem cells, which are the hypothesized seeds of tumor recurrence. An ideal marker for glioblastoma cancer stem cell isolation and therapeutic targeting would be specifically expressed only by cancer stem cells, but would be absent in normal adult brain tissue. The authors used unbiased genome-wide expression profiling analysis to discover differentially upregulated genes in glioblastoma stem cells in comparison to normal human brain tissue, neural stem cells, and glioblastomas. 19 upregulated cell surface-associated genes were identified in cancer stem cells, and these were subsequently validated by quantitative reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction. The most distinctive transcript, cadherin-19, was upregulated in four glioblastoma stem cell lines and was virtually absent in neural stem cells, normal human astrocytes, and patient-matched glioblastoma cells. Using immunoblot analysis, the authors observed cadherin-19 protein in two glioblastoma stem cell lines that initiate less invasive glioblastoma xenografts. Cadherin-19 upregulation is associated with a more favorable prognosis and survival in patients from the large National Cancer Institute's Rembrandt database. Because cadherin-19 expression is restricted to cells of the developing nervous system and absent in the adult brain, it has future potential as a useful marker for glioblastoma stem cell isolation and therapeutic targeting. Brief pain inventory facial minimum clinically important difference. A clinical article by Sukhmeet Sandhu and co-authors. The measurement of pain in patients with trigeminal neuralgia pain is challenging since no person can feel or perceive another's pain. It is thus important to use patient-reported outcome tools to measure outcomes. In this study, the Brief Pain Inventory Facial Questionnaire, or BPI Facial for short, was administered before and after neurosurgical intervention. This questionnaire is a reliable and validated tool that measures multiple domains of pain from the patient's perspective, including pain intensity and how pain interferes with activities of daily living. This 18-question scale provides quantitative outcome data that allows practitioners to measure change scores. Since statistically significant differences from baseline may not be considered clinically relevant by the patient him or herself, the authors used two techniques to measure the minimal clinically important difference, also called the MCID. 234 patients with trigeminal neuralgia were enrolled in this study. Statistical methods were used to establish threshold cutoffs for clinically relevant domains of pain. Interestingly, the authors found that patients who rated themselves as improved after neurosurgical intervention reported greater percentage changes in quality of life compared to pain intensity alone. Indeed, the measurement of pain intensity alone, in other words, how sharp or severe the pain is, may not be sufficient to capture the full experience of patients. Instead, it is the effect of pain on quality of life that patients desperately need cured. Neuroendoscopic biopsy of brain lesions, accuracy and complications. A clinical article by Alexandre Varela Gianetti and co-workers. The authors analyzed the accuracy of neuroendoscopic biopsy of ventricular and periventricular lesions and report on its difficulties and complications. 50 patients with different entities underwent endoscopic biopsy. The biopsy result was considered diagnostic if the pathologist reported any specific finding on which clinicians could base decisions about treatment or observation. The biopsy result was referred to as accurate if the results matched results of a sample obtained later, or if the treatment response and disease evolution were compatible with the diagnosis. The biopsy result was considered inaccurate if results showed any relevant differences from those of the later sample, or if the patient's disease did not evolve as expected. In two cases, the procedure had to be abandoned. The biopsy diagnostic rate was 89.6%, and its accuracy was 86%. There were 3 significant hemorrhages, 2 infections, no reoperations, and 1 death related to the procedure. The authors found endoscopic biopsy to be accurate and to have acceptable morbidity and mortality rates. Complications of epilepsy surgery in Sweden from 1996 to 2010, a prospective population-based study. A clinical article by Johan Bjelvi and colleagues. Robust data on benefits and risks are of equal importance when counseling patients for epilepsy surgery. In this study, the authors analyze prospectively collected complication data from the Swedish National Epilepsy Surgery Register. Complications are classified as major if the consequences affect daily life and last more than 3 months, and classified as minor if they resolve within 3 months. Between 1996 and 2010, 865 therapeutic epilepsy surgery procedures were performed. 158 of them were reoperations. There were no deaths. Major complications occurred in 3% of the procedures, minor complications in 7.5%. The risk for complications increased significantly with age. The authors found no cutoff above which the risk was unacceptably high, and no major complications among patients older than 50 years. They therefore conclude that older age should be considered in counseling, but should not be regarded as a contraindication to surgery. The overall complication rates in this study align well with those from larger single centers with similar study methodology. This confirms the safety of epilepsy surgery in Sweden. The major strengths of the study are the large cohort, the prospective data collection, and the population-based nature of the database. The authors therefore judge that their study can provide a valid basis for patient information and quality control in epilepsy surgery. The results of a third Gamma Knife procedure for recurrent trigeminal neuralgia. A clinical article by Zachary Temple and co-authors. The authors reviewed the clinical outcomes after a third Gamma Knife radiosurgery procedure in 17 patients with intractable and recurrent trigeminal neuralgia. 8 patients obtained complete relief and 8 had pain improvement at an average of 3 months after the procedure. No patient suffered additional sensory loss of the face. After 2 years, complete pain control was maintained in 6 patients, while 7 others reported pain improvement. For elderly or medically infirm patients with medically and surgically refractory trigeminal neuralgia, many of whom are taking chronic antiplatelet or anticoagulant therapy, a third gamma knife radiosurgery procedure provided satisfactory outcomes. Intraoperative stereotactic injection of indigo carmine dye to mark ill-defined tumor margins. A prospective phase 1 to 2 study. A clinical article by Konstantinos Margetis and co-workers. This Food and Drug Administration-approved investigational new drug study enrolled adult patients with presumed gliomas scheduled for surgical resection. For these patients, the extent of tumor resection is critical for maximizing overall and recurrence-free survival. However, the margins between neoplastic tissue and normal parenchyma are often difficult to distinguish intraoperatively. Viable options include neuronavigation, which is susceptible to brain shift, and intraoperative MR imaging, which carries cost and operative time limitations. The authors studied a different approach to this issue. They marked specific points of the tumor margins by injecting indigo carmine dye. The injections were performed under frameless stereotactic guidance, through burr holes, and before bone flap elevation and any brain shift. The injection points remained accurately labeled throughout the procedure, which was conducted in standard fashion. When the resection reached the injection points, the surgeon was able to recognize the blue-stained tissue and optimize the resection according to the goal of maximal tumor resection with minimal disruption of normal tissue. Postoperative MR images verified complete resection of the tissue marked with indigo carmine. This study shows that this technique can be used to mark deep tumor margins, which can be identified during surgery for adequate resection. Clinical, radiological, and pathological features in 43 cases of intracranial subependymoma. A clinical article by Xiong B and colleagues. Intracranial subependymomas are rarely reported due to their extremely low incidence. The authors analyzed the incidence and clinical, radiological, and pathological features of intracranial subependymoma in patients treated over a period of 10 years at their hospital in Beijing. During this period, 43 patients were treated for intracranial subependymoma out of approximately 60,000 patients treated for intracranial tumors. Thus, the authors calculated that intracranial subependymomas accounted for approximately 0.07% of intracranial tumors. In almost 80% of these cases, the subependymomas had been misdiagnosed on imaging. Pathologically, 34 of the lesions were pure subependymomas. 8 were mixed with ependymoma, and 1 was mixed with astrocytoma. Follow-up data were available for 35 of the 43 patients. Of these 35 patients, 3 experienced tumor recurrence, and 1 died. Univariate analysis revealed a strong association between shorter progression-free survival and age less than 14 years, as well as poorly defined lesion borders. Multivariate analysis confirmed only poorly defined borders to be an independent prognostic factor for shorter progression-free survival. In patients 14 years of age or older, subependymomas tended to be pure subependymomas located in the unilateral supratentorial area, and gross total resection tended to be easier, with longer progression-free survival. In younger patients, the lesions tended to be mixed tumors involving the bilateral subtentorial area, with a lower rate of gross total resection and shorter progression-free survival. The authors conclude that intracranial subependymoma is a rare benign tumor with definite radiological features. Long-term survival can be expected. Given the observed differences between cases involving older and younger patients, the authors hypothesize that adult and childhood tumors might have different origins, biological behaviors, and prognoses. In vivo measurement of the frame-based application accuracy of the NeuroMate neurosurgical robot. A technical note by Daniel von Langsdorff and co-authors. Although robots have been used in neurosurgery for nearly 25 years, very few independent data concerning their in vivo accuracy are available in the scientific literature. The authors measured the in vivo application accuracy of the NeuroMate neurosurgical robot in frame-based deep brain stimulation procedures, with a system independent from the robot. This accuracy was better than 1 millimeter on average, and the localization errors never exceeded 1.5 millimeters. The accuracy of the NeuroMate robot was at least similar to the accuracy of stereotactic frame arms and consequently is compatible with the accuracy required in deep brain stimulation procedures. Further, objective evaluations of robot accuracy and safety will facilitate the development of robotics in neurosurgery. Moderate and severe traumatic brain injury. Effect of blood alcohol concentration on Glasgow Coma Scale score and relation to computed tomography findings. A clinical article by Nils Petter Rundhaug and co-workers. Alcohol intoxication is seen in a large proportion of patients with traumatic brain injury, and treatment guidelines are largely based on the patient's level of consciousness at admission. The effects of alcohol intoxication on the level of consciousness are not clearly understood, and the results of studies have been conflicting. In this prospective study, the authors looked at the significance of degree of alcohol intoxication on level of consciousness in moderate and severe traumatic brain injury after adjustment for injury severity based on the patient's acute CT findings. The main finding was that alcohol intoxication decreased the level of consciousness in the total patient group. When the patients were stratified into two injury severity groups, based on the imaging findings, this effect was enhanced in the least injured group, whereas the effect disappeared among the most seriously injured patients. This finding is in agreement with the assumption of many clinicians that alcohol is not of importance for level of consciousness among the most severely injured patients. Reduced consciousness, however, must not be attributed to alcohol intoxication before a head CT scan is performed. Some patients may also have reduced consciousness due to severe traumatic axonal injury that is not visible on CT scans. The endoscopic endonasal approach to the odontoid and its impact on early extubation and feeding. A clinical article by Tony Goldschlager and colleagues. Endoscopic endonasal surgery has undergone a revolution. Technological advances, new techniques, and increasing experience has led to the ability to deal with an increasing range of pathologies from the odontoid to the crista galli. Resection may be rarely indicated to treat a range of conditions that can affect the odontoid process. The gold standard technique to access the odontoid has been through the transoral route. This approach necessitates opening of the oropharynx and is associated with risks of infection and swallowing and breathing complications. The endoscopic endonasal approach has the potential to reduce these complications as the oral cavity is avoided. To date, there are fewer than 25 such cases reported. This paper is a consecutive, single-institution series of 9 patients who underwent the endonasal endoscopic approach to the odontoid. Patient outcomes were comprehensively assessed, both clinically and radiographically, with a particular focus on time to extubation and resumption of oral feeding. This series of 9 cases of endonasal endoscopic odontoidectomy adds significantly to the existing literature, not only in the number of cases relative to the small number already published, but more importantly in the results, which are markedly better than previous reports. These cases highlight the advantages of the endonasal endoscopic approach in permitting early extubation, early feeding, and minimizing complications compared with transoral surgery. Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. And for more information on how to submit your research to the Journal of Neurosurgery, please visit thejns.org and click on Info for Authors.